So this is talking with Dennis Sciama on 24th January 1978 at the University of Washington. So could you tell me just what your undergraduate and graduate training was in and when you first heard about radio astronomy?
I read maths and physics as an undergraduate, which was towards the end of the war. And then I went into the army, but during the later part of my army period, I worked at a government research establishment called TRE.
Oh, yes.
Where much of the radar work was done during the war. And I worked on the lead sulfide class of photodetectors, which were being studied because of the possibility of detecting enemy aircraft from their heat
from
radiation.
The heat, yeah.
And I worked on the quantum mechanics and group theory of the energy level distribution. And as a result of various memoranda I wrote then, I was accepted as a research student in Cambridge in 1949.
So this is a different TRE lab than the one that Ryle worked at, for instance?
I can't remember if he was actually at TRE. He certainly worked on radar during the war, but there was more than one place that did radar.
Yeah.
But there's only one TRE.
I think he was. Yeah.
Yes, but that was at an earlier period. Mm-hmm.
And so then you went to Cambridge as an undergraduate and graduate student also?
Yes, I went back to Cambridge as a research student. And I started working actually in statistical mechanics. But in the middle of that, I got interested in relativity. And I got to know Hermann Gondi and Tommy Gold through that. And I got my doctorate in 1953.
I see. And you've already mentioned it to me that you were at this conference in 1951 held at University College in London?
It was, I believe, yes.
Right, and do you have any recollections as to what this field was at that time?
Oh, yes, I remember quite clearly, because at that time there were already a number of discrete radio sources known, of course, but they hadn't been identified, and there was much argument as to just where they were located, in particular whether they were nearby in our own galaxy or were extragalactic. And there was an amusing argument where Martin Ryle took the view that on the basis of whatever details were known about their distribution and intensity and so on at that time, that they had to be in the galaxy, he thought, and that there were so many of them that their integrated radiation could be held responsible for the diffuse background
right,
of the galaxy.
Right.
This was before the days of the synchrotron hypothesis. Mm-hmm. Whereas I recall Fred Hoyle and Tommy Gold suggesting that since the sources were distributed isotropically around us, they could either be very close and thereby not revealing the shape of the galaxy, or they could just as well be very distant and be extragalactic, and that there were some reasons for thinking that it was fruitful to consider them extragalactic. And so there was a conflict on that point.
Now, were Hoyle and Gold already at that stage interested in the possibilities of using this as a cosmological test?
No, I don't think the idea of counting radio sources and using the log n log s was around at that time. I suppose too few sources were known and so on. The first published discussion was the Ryle-Scheuer paper of 1955.
Right.
That was a bit later.
Right. So when did you personally get started in this whole brouhaha that developed?
Well, when I switched over to relativity, I got personally friendly with Bondi and Gold, and because they helped to develop the steady-state theory, I got interested in those questions, although I hadn't worked on that theory. I think it came into my thesis in one place, but it wasn't my main concern. I was working on Mach's principle for my main thesis. But through knowing them, I got interested in all the astronomical aspects of cosmology. So already by 1951, which was before I finished as a student, I was interested enough to go to this conference.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started working on the steady-state theory a bit just after my thesis. I discussed, for instance, galaxy formation in the mid-50s. So when hostile evidence began to emerge, I was interested in that. And by that time, I'd become attached to the theory for its aesthetic virtues, as I took them to be at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So when the hostile evidence began to come out, I tried to see whether that evidence could be refuted. So I got a bit involved in the discussions from then on.
And so you became one of the camp of steady-state backers at that time. Would you say that's fair?
That's certainly true,
right.
Yes.
And so what was the main argument that you had against let's be careful about when. Now, when the 2C results first came out, as well as their analysis by Ryland Scheuer, did you have arguments at that time about this interpretation?
I don't think I was involved myself till a bit later, although I followed what was going on. And it wasn't many years after that that there was the counts from Australia Mills. By Mills, which disagreed in detail. In the region of overlap of the two surveys, they were quite different. And it became evident that the Cambridge survey was confusion limited and that their results were unreliable in the interesting region where there were many sources where the slope was in excess of what it ought to have been. And the Mills survey, as I recall, gave in fact essentially the Euclidean slope mm-hmm. to within the
accuracy. Right, 1.8 formally is what they came up with.
Oh, that's right. It was not 1.5. It was already 1.8 in 1958, I think.
Yes.
But they said, I think, it's 1.8, but not incompatible with 1.5,
exactly.
Given the uncertainties. That was their position at that time. But we developed various ways of trying to deal with this hostile evidence. One was clearly to exploit the fact that there was this conflict between different sets of observers. And one view we took was simply, well, if the observers can't agree, we just keep quiet until they do agree, and then see what our position is. But it also began to be possible to make the following point. The nature of the alleged anomaly was that there were too many faint sources than could be accounted for by the steady state theory. But of course, it could be accounted for by evolution in a Big Bang theory. But an alternative way of interpreting the same data would be to say there were too few bright sources, because it depends where you normalize the curve. But that makes a difference, because too few bright sources is something that one could accommodate by a statistical fluctuation or attempt to.
Well, that was the argument as to whether that made us in too special a location, was it?
Or so it was a matter of detail, how big, because
right.
if we were in a local hole,
right.
as Hoyle and Nalikar discussed, for an extragalactic distribution of sources, you try and make the parameters such that the hole was not too big, nor too isotropic. That was another problem, because we shouldn't be at the center of the hole. And there was much argument about how convincing that explanation was. Then in the early 60s, I proposed, ironically enough, a bit the model that Ryle had favored in 1951, namely that there was a class. By then, of course, some of the sources had been identified, and we knew they were extragalactic, like Cygnus A and so forth. But many sources, even today, in what then became the 3C catalogue, which was superseded 2C, even today many of those sources
sure.
are not identified, and of course even more were not identified then. And this was before quasars were discovered.
Oh, there must have been only 10% identified in the 3C survey at the beginning.
That's right.
At most.
So I investigated the possibility that there were two classes of radio source. This was before quasars, so I had a certain kind of prescience, although I'm not really claiming that seriously. That there were two classes of radio source, the extragalactic ones that the kind of were already known by then, like Cygnus A, and another class, invented ad hoc, I completely admit, to save the steady state theory, but that were galactic. The point being that then the size of the local hole, well, it was the galactic ones, of course, that gave the anomalous slope, and the idea was that we were in a local hole, so there was a shortage of bright sources for that reason. But the hole didn't have to be all that large according to the parameters I could. And the distribution of those sources was rather similar to the distribution Ryle had thought to exist in the galaxy in 1951.
With his radio stars.
Yes, whose integrated radiation made a lot of the background,
mm-hmm.
and whose individual properties were similar to the ones Ryle took. But as I say, the size of the local hole was then, if I remember, something like 15 parsecs, whereas Hoyle's local hole was so many megaparsecs that it was already not small compared with cosmological distances,
right.
at least for you know, galaxy distribution.
And that paper was published when?
I published two or three papers of that kind around 62, 63. But all the time, of course, the radio astronomers at Cambridge were getting better data and the isotropy was being improved. So there was a bit of a controversy between us as to whether the data could admit such an interpretation. And then the quasars were discovered, and that produced a curious twist, because that could then have been my second population, except that they have large redshifts. But to complicate the matter, several people, including Hoyle himself, took the view, and to some extent perhaps still does today, that the redshift might have had some other explanation than the Hubble effect. And therefore they might be in the galaxy, but with, say, gravitational redshift. But I was a bit I thought it was getting too ad hoc to pile that onto my own model. So I didn't take the view that the quasar redshifts was furious. I mean, were not cosmological. And I tried having two populations of objects, quasars with known redshifts, which were extragalactic, and another family of quasars that were in the galaxy. But of course, it was getting rather less convincing by then. But when major questions are at stake, you try a bit hard, and of course, you reach a point where your models are too artificial, but you don't mind a little bit of artificiality at first while you're playing around, because you don't want to give in too easily. You right. don't want to be obstinate and never give in, but you can't give in the minute a piece of hostile evidence comes, because it can always have some meaning you didn't realize.
Or just
first.
Be playing wrong.
Or be playing wrong. So, one therefore played with lots of these models and so on, and it wasn't until a little later that it became evident that the model couldn't be sustained. But as a matter of fact, the actual observation that led me to abandon the steady-state theory was the following thing, which I did in collaboration with Martin Rees, who was then a student of mine. In fact, we were the first people to point out, but Martin Schmidt did a much better job later, that if you just take the quasars of known redshifts, which we couldn't do earlier because there wasn't the data, and plot something equivalent to log n log s, namely the number redshift relation for the quasars in 3C, there were too many quasars of large redshift for the steady-state theory to be valid, and we published that. We were, in fact, the first to publish that discussion. And that can, and since I didn't want to have these quasars not cosmological, I really gave in at that point, I mean, in a psychological sense, inside myself. Mm-hmm. And then, 2 or 3 years later, Schmidt did a much more detailed job.
And did you have the V over Vmax? Sort of?
No, I was going to say, because we didn't pay careful attention to all the selection effects, radio and optical and so on, which Schmidt did. And Schmidt had more data, his own data, in fact, when he did his discussion. So his discussion certainly superseded ours, but and is now always the one that's quoted, which I don't mind. But in fact, we were the first to publish the statement that...
So it sounds like that this was the final nail in the coffin of the steady state, rather than the microwave background.
Because at that time, it had only recently been discovered. I'm talking, I think it was 1966 when we did the NZ relation. And the microwave background was only a year old then.
Right.
And indeed, I also made a model of that, attributing it to the integrated effect of a discrete distribution of sources throughout the universe, which in 1966 one could just
about
do.
When you only have 2 or 3 points on
that's
the curve.
Right. You wouldn't want to simulate a full Planck blackbody curve, but a bit of nu squared you could perhaps simulate.
Right.
And later, though, there was another argument against that the high isotropy of the background meant you weren't seeing root n fluctuations, and therefore there had to be a very large number of sources. But again, the data didn't exist in 66. So I just, in the same spirit, I made a model of the background, which I abandoned, of course, a few years later when the data became much clearer. Mm-hmm. But so that for that reason, therefore, it was the quasar distribution that actually made me recant.
I see. Now, going back to the point where you said you could take the attitude when the Mills and Ryle survey existed side by side and so flatly disagreed with each other of just waiting and seeing, let them straighten it out. I would think it would be very frustrating to the cosmologists who had spent a decade or more developing to find this great disagreement. But is that all you could do, was to just wait?
Well, first of all, that always happens in science. I mean, there's often a conflict of data from different observers in any branch of experimental physics or observational astronomy. Surely that is so.
Yeah.
There's nothing special to
well,
this problem.
Well, this is a particularly striking example, though, I think.
I'm sure if I dredge my memory, I could think of lots of cases of conflict of evidence, which sometimes is settled rather rapidly, and it didn't take long in this case, actually, but... So that was not unusual.
Well,
I would say.
It took almost a decade in this case, really, from the mid-50s to...
Well, by 1962, wasn't it, there was the Scott and Ryle paper, which...
Yes, that's right.
...which got 1.8. So by then, the agreement was more essential agreement, I would have said.
Well, I guess there was still some feuding going on, but you're right. Certainly things were coming closer.
So that wasn't more than 3 or 4 years, from, say, 1958. As regards being frustrated, well, but I mean, again, this is quite common in physics. If there's conflicting evidence, unless the theorist himself understands very deeply the experiments and their technique, He might privately favour one observer rather than another or something, but you know, as long as they're both reputable observers, there's nothing much you can do except wait. Well, you can go on theorising, but otherwise you have to wait till the data settles down.
And essentially just move to a new problem.
Yes.
But now you mentioned that, and I think the timing you gave it was 58 or something like that, that it became clear that they were confusion limited. But was it really that soon that it was sort of obvious that this was the problem with the 2C survey, or is that a bit of hindsight coming in?
Well, I'm afraid I can't now remember offhand when it became evident.
Scheuer had this P of D analysis, of course, which in a sense could be interpreted as admitting that we're confusion limited, but look, we can still do something with all of our little bumps.
That's true, and of course the results they got from that were rather similar to the modern results, so I would have thought that was fair enough. But I think it became evident when the Ryle and Mills surveys were compared that the confusion was occurring, because one group couldn't see sources the other group could and so on, and I think it became fairly soon evident that that was the reason. But I don't, without looking up the literature, again, I don't offhand remember the exact year in which the Cambridge people were quite clear that that was going on.
Okay, well, that was... What about the POD analysis? Did this have much weight with you?
Oh, yes, because I was making models, you see, accepting a steep slope. I mean, my models of a local hole meant that I accepted the steep slope, or whether the steepness was one value or another was getting more into the details, but that there was an anomaly to be explained was what required the local hole business. So the P of D just emphasized that that was the situation. It didn't really change it fundamentally.
And then when the Mills survey came along, I suppose the thing to say is that, well, then you wouldn't have to work so hard on these models with a steep slope. Then you can.
Well, the less steep the slope, of course, the smaller the local hole or something, the less alarming the model.
Right, that's what I mean. So then you could sit back and say, aha, well, this is going more towards what we would have expected before if we had to predict something.
That's right, and as Mills said, 1.8 with his errors was compatible with 1.5. Of course, though even 1.5 is anomalous, don't forget.
Right, from the studies, yes.
Because we've got to make the redshift corrections, and you should really have even less than 1.5. Right. So it's not as though 1.5 resolved the problem.
But it's not too much less than 1.5, is it?
Well, it depends on the details, of course. Yeah. It depends on how far out you're probing and so on. Because the corrections are small for nearby objects, large for distant objects.
But, I mean, in terms of what the sort of parameters that people were putting in, I believe the numbers were 1.3 and 4. Is this?
Well, it's not, strictly speaking, it's not even a fixed slope, you see. It's a slope that's varying with the intensity, you see, because at high intensities you asymptote to 1.5 because the redshift corrections are negligible on anybody's theory. And for very distant objects, the corrections are important. But in any case, at one intensity you're seeing nearby and distant objects because of the spread,
so the intrinsic luminosity. So the intrinsic luminosity is that you're scaling your luminosity function with.
That's right.
As to where you are on this continually changing slope.
That's right.
Okay, well, we've concentrated on this particular issue. Before, were there any other developments during the 1950s that you as a cosmologist saw in radio astronomy that related to cosmology?
Well, of course, the discovery of quasars and their large redshifts.
Okay, that was a little bit later in the 50s, I'm thinking.
Oh, you said, I'm so sorry, yeah. You said the 50s, yeah, not the 60s, right. Excuse me.
For instance, the identification of Cygnus A, do you see this as being of import?
Well, of course, that occurred before the Ryle-Scheuer accounts. That was in 1954.
52. Well, it was published in 54. It actually 52.
Oh, was it?
Became known.
I see. I remember the year of publication. Yes.
Paper,
And of course, that's what Ryle used then. Then he had to accept the extragalactic picture, and he realized immediately, given that since Cygnus A was the second brightest radio source in the sky and was already whatever it is, I forget the distance offhand.
Well, it's a redshift of 18,000 kilometers a second.
So if an object that distant was the second brightest in the sky, one could clearly see radio galaxies, as they were later called, so far away that optically they wouldn't be visible even. And therefore one could do accounts probing the universe to much greater depths than the 200-inch telescope could. So... So in fact, the identification of Cygnus A was the very development that led Ra to realize that by counting radio sources he could probe the universe to great depths. But I think at that time, if I recall correctly, that was the only strictly cosmological consequence of radio astronomy. There were lots of astrophysical consequences, like the processes going on in radio galaxies, but I think that was the only cosmological one. Various things came later. I mean, you had to have the quasars to do the Gunn-Peterson absorption trough business for intergalactic hydrogen, and the fact that quasars have large redshift meant you could look at redshifts of two and so on. And all that, as you say, came in 1965, was the first redshift of two.
I think that is right, now that I'm thinking myself, and you mentioned in a paper in Vistas in Astronomy in 1960 that perhaps the idea of very redshifted hydrogen line observations would be of great service to cosmology.
Well, that, as I recall, was on the basis of some
erroneous measurements, as it turned out.
Yes.
But I suppose the idea was that this may be a way to get redshifts. Technically, it's a better way to get redshifts than optically. Was that really what you were thinking?
Well, I'm not sure whether it's better, but at least by being different, it's likely to be informative. Of course, recently, it looks as though we've discovered cases of absorption at 21 centimeters in the spectra of distant quasars with a foreground galaxy containing the neutral hydrogen. Perhaps that's beginning to come in after all.
But I think the thrust of what you were saying there was the object itself, getting the redshift of the object itself, not intervening.
Oh, sure, sure. You're detecting. All right, but then what I now mean is that you're detecting the redshift of the intervening galaxy by 21 centimeter lines, just seen in an absorption instead of emission.
True.
But then.
The trouble is, you can't see these galaxies yet optically.
No, there's one case where you can. There is a case, in fact, it's very interesting for another reason. There's a case of a quasar which contains an absorption line at 21 centimeters, which has the same redshift as that of a galaxy which is known. Its optical redshift is known, which lies nearly in the line of sight. And the line of sight passes within something like 100 kiloparsecs of this galaxy.
Oh, yes. You're talking about the one by Burke and company?
But also, they have noted, Sargent and someone have now found, is it calcium in absorption at the same redshift, which shows that there's calcium in this galaxy 100 kiloparsecs out, which has all sorts of implications.
I hadn't heard about the optical part of that. Well, this is a matter of the idea of what is the density of intergalactic matter. Was this thought of at all in the 50s as possibly radio astronomy might?
Oh, that's true. There were limits on that from looking for, the 21 centimeter line in emission, not at, of course, at a line, but integrated. And George Field and others looked at that. They looked for it both in absorption and in emission.
Right.
And as I recall, placed limits comparable with, but not quite as good as, the density that would be just needed to close the universe at that time. In fact, George Field was working on that, I think, when I shared an office with him in Harvard in 1955.
He was a graduate student, I think. Or was he a...
No, he was then a member of the Society of Fellows. He was a junior fellow at the Society of Fellows. He'd been got his PhD at Princeton.
He's on my list. I haven't gotten him yet. Speaking of which, this is not directly related to history of radio astronomy, but it's my reading of it that there does not seem to be the concern with the overall mean density of the universe that is so a great concern now, is the universe open or closed, in the 50s. Is this true?
Well, I was very interested in intergalactic medium, and in fact, I was one of the few people writing papers on that subject until it became popular later.
What?
And indeed, I'm glad to say that, because with the Gunn-Peterson thing, not seeing the absorption trough and all that, one attributed that to a very hot gas. And I had in fact proposed, for other reasons, that the gas would be very hot through essentially things like cosmic ray heating, already a year or two before the Gunn-Peterson effect was discovered.
Hmm. But this lack of concern at this time, what do you attribute?
For one thing, there was rather a lack of concern in cosmology at all. It was very much a fringe subject. And then there were some people who felt that it was speculative to say there was extra matter. I could never understand that point of view. It was as though God was parsimonious, would not make more stuff than you can actually see at that time. Uh-huh. Whereas I took the view that God could just as easily make as much matter as wouldn't have been detected, because you mustn't, of course, break the upper limits. And if that's an interesting form of matter and might lead to future detection, you ought to study its possible properties. Mm-hmm. So this is, of course, a difference between sort of a rather conservative and a rather open, more adventurous, I don't know what you call it, an open-minded right. attitude, which no doubt is a bit similar to why some people like the steady-state theory and others didn't. So I did a bit of work on the intergalactic medium in those years, but I was one of very few people doing that sort of thing.
Was this simply because of a lack of the observational capability, both optical and radio, to probe?
I suppose it was mainly that. Whereas I'm attracted to fundamental questions, and you can't always wait to work on a problem that could only if something detectable emerges in a year from then. Sometimes you have to do rather more academic things.
Well, this is always a question of interest as to which leads which. The observations lead the theory, or the theory lead the observations. And what you're saying is that in this case the observations needed to come first to spark the interest amongst the theorists.
Well, among general interest, yes, but my belief is rather obvious that it's a two-way process. And one ought to study. I don't mean you study absolutely any problem, however arcane or speculative it is, but since galaxies formed and couldn't have always existed, it's a natural question to say, well, how efficient was the galaxy formation process? How much was left over between the galaxies? And it's perfectly natural to then discuss the astrophysics of that gas that was left over. And who knows what observational methods will emerge in future years. So you don't wait till they've emerged to work on the subject. You prepare for that by working on it anyway. That's if you're in cosmology. But of course, at that time, there were very few cosmologies anyway. And perhaps most of those were more mathematicians interested in the geometry of space-time and solutions of Einstein's equations, whereas I started working on the physical properties of the gas, and many of the relativists were not, in that sense, physicists.
You alluded to something which you mentioned to me earlier today, namely the difference in philosophical bent of one who would believe in steady state and one who might not. Could you just, for the record, see how you see them as being different in terms of the sort of person that's attracted to them?
Well, believe is too strong an expression. I would say be sympathetic with the steady-state theory, let's say, rather than
believe.
Well,
the line becomes fuzzy.
Well, I think a better word is... No, because why should you believe it to be true if there's no evidence for or against, which was the early situation? There was nothing to make you believe it to be true, to be fair. The point is rather...
To favor it.
Yes, but what does favoring mean? I think the hard cash test is favoring means do you work on it? You see, if you like the theory, you actually do calculations in it, or you defend it when hostile evidence begins to come, but you have to then debate it. So it affects how you actually work, mm-hmm. but questions of literal belief, I don't think, are relevant at that stage. Later they would
Sorry,
be. I'm not trying to be pedantic about it. I think it's an important point, because there wasn't sufficient reason to say it was true, but just that since it was a very attractive theory, one tried to help to make it clear that it was in fact true by working out its consequences, and some of the problems it gave rise to were very interesting theoretical problems anyway, and the link with observation. As to personal types, I once made a little joke that A believed in the steady state theory because he wasn't religious, and B believed it because he was. It's an adaptation of a joke of Bertrand Russell's, actually. But I felt that the overall beauty of the model and the fact that life would always be possible somewhere in a steady-state universe was psychologically attractive to me, and that counterbalanced the unattractive feature that you have to change the laws of physics, which of course you don't do lightly. Whereas for other people those attractions weren't so great, and looming larger for them was the undesirability of changing the laws of physics. So that's very much a personal matter.
So it would be the more conservative viewpoint in the 50s, you would say, to not believe in the steady state.
Oh, undoubtedly, because it was saying that the conservation of matter was false, and that was one of the keystones of physical theory.
On the other hand, in those histories that have been told, and certainly in elementary textbooks, the two are always put up against each other as being equally likely, and then the evidence for one, the evidence for the other. It's not a matter of here comes this radical new theory. They're sort of given equal weight, it seems to me.
Well, this might be a question of purposes of exposition, because I think if you counted heads, it was only a minority of people who were really sympathetic. And it certainly wasn't on the same footing in that it was a radical innovation, saying this law of conservation, which has been sacred for so long, is wrong and we must change physics. That can't be on the same footing as not changing physics. Naturally, it wasn't a ridiculous suggestion, because the actual creation rate was required was far less than the accuracy of the observations, but nevertheless...
Which was an unappealing thing, too. This could never be checked directly.
No, but it could be checked by observational tests of steady state, which, as the proponents of the theory kept harping on, you know, it's a very vulnerable theory, and that makes it very scientific. But I think it was more to clarify the exposition in popular books on cosmology, that they were given, as it were, in equal way. But I don't think that was the view most physicists took.
And as you said also before, there's also, of course, the great problem of the singularity in general relativity in the expanding universe, but that was only at least at one time, whereas you're violating the laws of physics everywhere, and that was Einstein's physics, which had been around for 50 years, and so that was not so bothersome. Would you say that's a fair...
I think so, yes. As a matter of fact, I met Einstein when I was at Princeton in 1955, just a week before he died, and I had quite a long talk with him, and I mentioned the steady-state theory, and he immediately said, it's not in agreement with the field equations. Which, of course, it wasn't, without tampering with them because of the conservation thing. So I told him the idea I had at the time about how to tamper with them, but of course he wasn't very sympathetic, and that's fair enough.
He tampered with his own, I guess.
Yes, but not in quite such a dramatic way.
Okay, so, and then you say the quasars were the next thing, what was the power of the quasars? Simply that they allowed you to probe that much further away from the
Earth? Well, we hoped they would. We hoped they would. Because of their great brightness, they could be seen to larger redshifts. But then it emerged that when you plotted one thing against another, that should have given a nice tight relation, which would have perhaps solved the cosmological problem, the famous scatter diagram emerged. And that was part of a controversy, because Hoyle and Burbidge claimed that showed that the quasars had to be local. And other people thought so it only meant that there was a wide distribution in intrinsic brightness and so forth.
But, well, even if that were true, however, some of them would allow you to probe very deeply, the most luminous, and if you could then come up with some other criterion for luminosity, such as spectrum or something else.
Well, but they're beginning to try and do that only today.
Right, right. But am I reading you right, then, that what you're saying is that as soon as the origin of the redshift was called into question, then the power of the quasars, in terms of deciding cosmological questions, at that stage in the early and mid-60s, greatly decreased?
No, that's not quite the point I was making. What I was saying is, even granted that the redshift is cosmological, they weren't useful in probing the universe, because the great spread in intrinsic properties of the quasars that were then implied by that interpretation...
At that time, you could not see any other hope of determining their luminosity. I mean, some other means of determining luminosity, so you decided to give up.
Well, I wouldn't put it quite like that. I mean, it wasn't a sort of one decided to give up as though that was foolish and one shouldn't have given up. No method emerged of getting rid of the scatter in a way that what they could be used for probing. So one couldn't do anything.
Yeah, and as you say, it's taken a decade to...
And even now, one is only beginning to perhaps be able to do that. So it wasn't a voluntary decision not to do something which one might have not decided that way. I mean, one simply had no choice.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's just about what I wanted to do. Thank you very much.
Fine.
That ends the interview with Dennis Sciama at the University of Washington on 24th January 1978. And this is the end of this side of the tape.